I don't know why my camera got blurry. Let me turn it off and on. Okay. The Commission on Equitable Housing and Development meeting is now commenced. It is March 2nd at 4 p.m. This meeting is being held virtually due to COVID-19 to allow for social distancing and to protect the public health. As we continue our efforts in meeting remotely, we ask that all commissioners and guests to mute yourselves until called upon to speak to avoid feedback and background noise. For those who have dialed in using the call-in number to unmute to speak, dial *6 on your phone. Also, prior to speaking, please announce who you are to identify yourself. As a reminder, this meeting is being recorded. We ask that you only use the chat function to request to speak or to announce that you are leaving the meeting so we can track quorum. Also, to comply with the state open meeting law, attendance and votes will be done by way of roll call using audio, not using the chat function. So we're going to do the roll call. Michael Edmonds.
I am present.
Sharia Jimenez.
Hi, you're present.
Jim Topol, I am here. Jay Young is absent. Mindy Bernstein.
Present.
Lori Mazurbo.
Present.
Kimbriana Washington.
Present.
Maggie Amato-Tayez is absent. Wendy Asher. Is Wendy here yet? Looks like Wendy's absent. Marianne Beerling. Okay, Marianne's also absent. Vicky Casino.
Here.
And Olga Flores is absent. Joanna Carr is on the in the waiting room. Has she officially given a resignation?
Let's let her in, and not that I'm aware of, which could really help for quorum today.
Okay. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, sorry I'm late. And yeah, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to be here, but I thought I'd join and see.
And I'll say, Joanna, hearing you have to step down, understandably, I do think let's do send us a resignation email, but after this meeting, because I believe Kimbriana has to leave. And so we just have quorum with you here. So that worked out really well.
Cool. And I'd still like to be involved. So
great.
Okay.
Well, we feel the same, and I feel confident you're going to move back to Tucson at some point.
I am. I'm so snowed in right now. My plan is to move back to Tucson in November. I'm not doing another winter. This was a bad idea.
No, you're in Flagstaff.
I'm in Flagstaff. Yeah.
Okay. So, looks like Wendy Asher has also joined us, so she is present.
Yes, apologies.
That will help too.
So, Jim, I don't actually think you called me.
Mark Clark.
Yes, here, present.
Okay. Yes, I missed you. I apologize, Mark. Okay, we have ex officio members as well. Liz Morales.
She'll be probably joined. She's at the chamber right now, but she'll be on eventually.
Okay. Corin Manning.
Present.
Marcos Ismail. Marcos is here. I can see him.
I'm here. Sorry, couldn't find the mute button.
Okay, and then Betty Villegas is absent. Okay, our second agenda item is the review and the adoption of the February 2nd meeting minutes. Those are on the website. I looked through them, and I just wanted to give a shout out to who does the meeting minutes again?
Stacy.
Who?
Stacy in our office, Stacy Bernatis.
Okay. And she is on, she's one of the attendees, so she may be hearing you.
So Stacy,
say nice things.
Good job. No, I thought that the level of detail in the meeting minutes was great. So I looked through them. Does anybody see any changes that they'd like to make to the meeting minutes? Okay, then without objection, the minutes are approved. Agenda item 3 is the call to the audience. This is a time when any member of the public may address the Commission on Equitable Housing and Development. Due to time constraints, the total time allocated for this is 15 minutes. Individuals are allowed 3 minutes each. Due to open meeting laws, commission members cannot discuss topics that are not on the agenda, but items might be items brought up by the public may be considered as an agenda item for future meetings. So it looks like Ben Bueller Garcia would like to speak. So Ben, you have the floor.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, Ben Bueller Garcia on behalf of the Arizona Multi-Housing Commission. I'd like to speak to the implementation strategies you'll be talking about today for the poverty initiative. Two items in particular on the zoning code changes. I'd like to point out when you spoke to the mayor and council member Dahl wisely said that if we're going to expedite the permitting process for affordable housing, we should expedite it for everyone. And I think that's a good area to focus on. I'd encourage you to encourage the city to speed up the process. The permitting process at the city of Tucson right now is terribly, terribly broken with the conversion. Also, number 6, I'd strongly encourage you to avoid anything. Housing affordability is a citywide problem for everyone. And on item number 6, I'd strongly encourage you to avoid things like affordable housing impact fees and commercial impact fees that will raise the cost of building all types of housing here in the community. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben. Next, we have Victoria. I'm going to butcher this. Lonsi Barone. Is that
Lonestein Barone. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. You have the floor.
All right. I was just going to say, for housing the people, if we get the algorithm and we lay it out, who has housing, who doesn't, who's on Social Security because they can't afford 2.5 times the rent, what do we have out there that they can afford to make sure that those on the TPHC intake get those housings first? I have confidence that if the system is humane and is practical and you get feedback from the people using it, then you'll be able to get those people into housing, disabled or elderly, veterans, and other things like that. And to think about the housing equity model that's being used by CSH and Fuse, because when people come off the streets, they are completely traumatized, traumatized. So actually just daily living tasks are going to be extremely difficult. And since there's so many people and such a long wait list, as time goes by, the likelihood of them losing their minds in various ways is very high, especially while facing the weather. So my highly suggest as you expedite the ability to create housing, consider the disabled and those with traumatic brain injuries, and a model called Fuse by CHS that's already been used by HCD, to integrate them back into living in a home, or they will end up back on the street. Simple psychology and life skills is literally a huge barrier. So consider the disabled in various ways when you build the housing. There are small organizations that can help you understand what policies and stuff to expedite in the housing building program. And they can come in, assess the situation for somebody with a certain disability and know exactly what to build. So I'm highly suggestive of that. And that's pretty much all I wanted to say. Once you get the algorithm, I sent you guys information about how to house people away from, you know, life and death experiences on the street in Tucson. And I sent you emergency safety shelter and examples of that from other states that I came from. And so that should really help, because once you do find out how many people you're not able to help and how long you're not going to be able to help them, rather than thinking, oh my God, these people are going to die or go crazy or turn into things or something, I got you covered with those models. You can look at them. And then once you get to that point, it's all there for you. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Victoria. I appreciate it. Mindy, did you wish to speak?
Just Victoria said she sent materials to who and how do I find it?
Oh, that's a good question. Victoria, who did you send the email to?
The email, you guys only have one email that was given to me.
And whose was that?
The HCD one.
It was an HCD.
Yeah, Che sent it in the chat last time. You know, the CEHD. Yeah, you guys have it's basically listed on the website. So that's what I used.
Okay.
Okay. If it's the commission email, one of our members will get it off of there and can share with the other members.
Thank you.
Thank you, Victoria. Okay, anybody else would like to speak? Okay, we'll move on to agenda item number 4, which is a discussion to establish processes and guidelines to make our CEHD meetings and materials more accessible. Vicki is going to lead this discussion. So you have the floor, Vicki.
Oh, thanks. I don't know that we need all the time that was allotted. Jim and I talked, and Anne, just about, I've raised some accessibility issues, but I really want this commission as a commission on equity to sort of lead by example. And instead of continuing to raise issues, I had hoped that we could form an ad hoc committee where a couple or a small group of us could work on some best practices. We did come up with some ideas moving forward that city staff has promised, such as when materials will be provided to us. But there are some other things that easy things that could be put into place to just ensure that our meetings are easily accessible to everybody, but also to have guidelines for any guests that are coming in. So I'm looking for people to join me. And I don't know, Anne, did you have something to add?
I just I would think for an ad hoc committee, you would need at least 3 people, and it could meet once, how many times you need to meet, and then that ad hoc group can go away. And I do think some of the things we talked about, and really appreciate Vicki for helping teach us what's needed in terms of providing more accessibility, and at least, you know, we do want to ensure that we're trying to be as inclusive as we can be. So some of the things we agreed to, and it may impact meetings. If any presenters want to share information, that information has to be available to commissioners no later than Monday. And so if presenters, if guests, if people aren't able to give us that, we'll end up continuing that item to the next meeting. So just want to make people aware of the commitments we have made. And now I'll shush, and I see Mike has something to say.
Yeah, just a few quick comments, if it's okay, Jim.
Go ahead.
Okay, just checking with the chair. And I see Corin's on. So Corin, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've been in different meetings with different departments, and accessibility has come up. I know you said ad hoc, but I'm thinking, is this one of those situations where maybe we could do a study group to talk about it outside of a general commission meeting, and then come back to the commission with, hey, we talked about this, and these are the challenges and stuff like that. And Corin, if you want to jump in here, I thought I'd talk to you about it, but maybe it was somebody else. And I know that the websites and services that were working towards, the city, I should say, working towards more accessibility, but there are some changes that need to be technical changes.
So I'll take a crack at answering your question, Michael. So I think the goal is to, as Vicky said, is to create best practices or to create a set of guidelines for accessibility. Because, you know, this online meeting thing that we're all doing now is still relatively new. And it's, I don't believe that the accessibility guidelines are widely understood. At least they haven't been by me. And so what we have asked for is to basically create a document so that when we have guests and we can share them with the commission members and the guests, we could say, these are the guidelines for materials that are going to be presented. It includes like the, you know, the deadlines for when they need to be available, the fact that they need to be searchable, so on and so forth. And so the goal of this working group is to come up with those guidelines. And I agree with you. I think it's two or three meetings to develop them. And we need two or three volunteers to really help Vicky with this. So Wendell or Mark, sorry.
I volunteer.
Thank you, Mark. Corin?
I just wanted to quickly respond to Mike's comments, because what you might have been referring to or what we may have talked about is the new city website, and Ernesto might have more information, but the city is upgrading to a new web platform, and one of the goals is a better accessibility interface. So expect more on that and just improve city websites in the near future. But it does sound like these standards were trying to go a bit beyond that. So that's really great and exciting to hear.
Are there any other members who would like to participate in this working group?
I'm willing to be invited.
Attaboy. Thank you, Michael.
If I recall correctly, I think Jay also sort of indicated he'd help out. So we can, he's not here. We can volunteer.
I agree. No, I remember that as well. So I think, Vicky, are you good with that working group of you, Mark, Michael Edmonds, and Jay Young?
And me.
Oh, and Mindy. All right.
Yes, perfect. Thank you. And will there be somebody from the city?
Yeah, certainly. And Mike, one, whether it's ad hoc or kind of whatever you want to call it, we will have to do open meeting. So we will have to at least post that information.
Okay. And Vicky, are you comfortable chairing this ad hoc committee?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, any other comments or thoughts on this before we move to the next agenda item? Okay, agenda item number 5 is Allison Miller is going to be talking about the housing policies which are being considered for the county's prosperity initiative. So, Alan, you have the floor, or Allison, you have the floor.
Thanks. I'm just going to kick things off and invite Bonnie Bazzata and Nicole Fife from the county and Keith Bentel from the University of Arizona to give their presentation. But I think you have a lot of materials on the website and in your email that hopefully provide some really good context about what the Prosperity Initiative is and why we're bringing it to you. But just to give a really brief summary, the gist of it is that the city and county are cooperating regionally on a set of kind of multi-generational approaches to prosperity and poverty. And as a group very interested in housing, as you might imagine, housing has come up quite a lot in those conversations. And so the working group for the Prosperity Initiative is considering at least one, if not several, policies related to housing. And so I'll have handed over to Bonnie to kind of give an overview of the Prosperity Initiative and the policy that we're talking about today.
Great. Good afternoon. Thank you, everyone, so much for this opportunity to be with you. I'm Bonnie Bazzotta. I work with Pima County. I work on poverty issues. And my colleague, Nicole Fife, is here. She is a senior advisor in the county administrator's office. And then we have two researchers working with us, Keith Bentley. So we're going to split the presentation. I'm just going to give you a very brief overview on the Prosperity Initiative. I want to keep it relatively short so that we have time to dig into the housing policy. But please know that I'm delighted to go into any more detail on the initiative and also to get your feedback on other policies at any time in the future. So, but I want to make really good use of your time and just sort of jump into that. So I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. Can everybody see that okay? Great. So just a little bit of background. I really want to give credit to Councilmember Lane Santa Cruz for inviting me a year ago to give a presentation to Mayor and Council on poverty and really thinking of this as this historic moment, right? We're emerging out of this pandemic. And as everybody on the call knows, you know, we have high levels of poverty in our community. And we can assume that something's got worse for, especially for people who are already very vulnerable. And that the picture might look very different, except that we had some significant investments from the federal government. And there's a little chart on the side there, you know, kind of indicating that. But of course, many of those are being taken back to pre-pandemic levels. So we don't know what's going to happen. So, you know, as a result of that, we looked at how we could form a task force and a working group, as Allison said, to really think regionally. And to really think about who's been most impacted by poverty and by the pandemic. And of course, that's low-income children, women, single parents, and people of color. And also to see if we could really think about this generational approach. And, you know, so researchers often say we have these four approaches to addressing poverty. And frequently, if I were to poll this group and nearly every group I've been in front of, if I asked, if we give the whole landscape of the efforts we make to address poverty, we often put a lot of intention and effort on alleviating suffering for all kinds of really important and good reasons. But this initiative is really saying, how can we address these other three approaches? How can we really think generationally? So in 10 and 20 years, we might be able to see if we sort of bent the curve. And all of us on the call have probably heard that parable of the river, right? Where people are finding the kids floating down the river and villagers are plucking the kids out of the river. And somebody says, let's go upstream and find out who's throwing those babies in. So the Prosperity Initiative is really asking that question. How can we get more upstream? And so we have a working group with representation from the all the regional governments. And we are hope to add soon the Pascoyaki Nation. But that's great that we meet once a month, and grateful to the city in particular for bringing several of the departments and staff to this. So, you know, our purpose is to develop a set of policies that we want to make sure they're evidence-based, that they're guiding long-term efforts, that we're really thinking again about how we can build wealth and opportunity from the bottom up, but also and with that generational approach, but also thinking of how it addresses immediate needs. And with the idea, again, that we could have an adoption or adaptation by local and tribal governments. And so we have a set of guiding principles, and I'm happy to send any of this information in more detail to people, but we have these set of guiding principles. And we're, you know, trying to figure out how do we fit the toolbox, right? Because so often policy, especially in terms of poverty reduction, is written for the federal and the state government. So what fits in our toolbox for our different governmental structures? And I'll mention in a minute that we are going to be looking at programming. So we want to make sure we're gathering those ideas. If it's too big, you know, how can we potentially do advocacy at the state level? It has two phases. So this first phase through June is on policy development. And then the second phase is really then reviewing and analyzing our where we're currently putting our resources and then trying to align with those policies. The city of Tucson had asked if we could put three policies together for their April board meeting. And so we're sort of fast tracking those three. And of course, as Allison said, no surprise, at the top of everybody's list is affordable housing. We're doing lots of stakeholder engagement. We've had about 80 meetings, reached over 300 people. We've done some listening sessions with people in the community. We've been talking with national experts, and we'll continue to do as much of this as we can. We're about to launch a new website that has some engagement tools on there for surveys and discussion boards that we'll be using as well. And again, this is kind of intuitive, but you know, lots of the research tells us that if we can bundle these policies together, we're likely to have a greater impact. So we obviously don't have time to go into all of this, but we're investigating all these areas and these different policies to see where it's the best fit. And again, thinking that they have greater impact when we can have them as a package. So we have these two researchers working with us. We're very grateful to Brian Mayer, who many of you know, and also Keith Bentley, who's with the Southwest Institute for Research on Women. Keith's worked with us, many of you know, through the pandemic, really focusing on housing instability and potential homelessness and generating frequent reports on that. So we're really grateful to Keith and the research that he's done, and it's been provided the backdrop for this work on our housing policy. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Keith, who's going to start walking you through through the housing policy. So, Keith, can I turn it over to you?
Yes. Thanks so much, Bonnie. Mm-hmm. Hey, everybody. For those of you who don't know me, I'm an associate research professor at CERO, the Southwest Institute for Research on Women, as Bonnie just said. I'm a quantitative sociologist by training, and I've spent many, many years studying poverty, the safety net, and homelessness. So I was tasked with looking for policies in the area of housing that have the potential to break intergenerational cycles of poverty. In the research literature, I would say the very top of the list in terms of policies with established, like a very well-established evidence base, are those that focus on increasing mobility for low-income households. So reducing the geographic concentration of poverty is a kind of a major standard recommendation. You'll see that from lots of different policy institutes, poverty institutes and different policy organizations advocating for reducing poverty. And there's kind of two major mechanisms for that. One is to increase opportunities for people to move into higher opportunity areas. So that's the first one here. Efforts to increase the supply of affordable housing should prioritize practices and investments that reduce the geographic concentration of poverty and increase the number of mixed income neighborhoods. And then the second piece acknowledges that those opportunities should be prioritized. So in higher opportunity areas, the availability of affordable housing should be increased, and households with young children living in high poverty areas should be prioritized for access to these opportunities. So the research on housing mobility programs, which offer families in poverty the opportunity to relocate to low poverty areas, they found that there's positive effects for everyone, but the most dramatic positive effects are for children under six. Very young children who are relocated to these low poverty areas tend to have the best outcomes. So there's also a kind of a standard recommendation that those opportunities be prioritized for those children and the families with young children. Bonnie, if you can just go back for 1 second. I also just want to mention, and Bonnie, I didn't know how much time we want to spend on this today, but I wanted to be clear that we're now talking about kind of the suite of these three policies. The second policy here is focused on investments in high poverty areas with a focus on not displacing vulnerable residents that currently live in those areas. And then the third one is looking at homeownership, support for homeownership to support low-income families to increase housing stability for those families and for their communities. So the first one we've spent the most time on so far, but those next two are kind of what we're seeing as a suite of policies that we hope to push together. Thanks. Thanks, Bonnie. So this was the text that I read. I think we can go to the next one. And then the tactical element that we identified on this is that research suggests that adults and children, upon relocating, experience immediate improvements in their quality of life, their mental health, and their education and employment opportunities. And the strategic element here is really focused on the long-term benefits to children. And this is an area where having longitudinal data that goes over decades that can show you what actually happened with kids in these programs is very hard to find in general. But we have a kind of a unique situation where there were a number of programs in Chicago in the 1960s and then a big moving to opportunity program that was implemented in the 60s and 70s. That has produced data from that's people have circled back to those families in the 1990s and in the 2000s. So that research is coming through now showing these very long-term benefits for those children in terms of their college attendance, their educational opportunities, and their earnings being significantly better and higher on average than kids that did not have those opportunities to relocate. Here is an example of a very optimistic idea of having a sort of a nationwide housing mobility program that would support low-income families to relocate to more resource-rich neighborhoods. And using the estimates from the studies I mentioned, the movement to opportunity study in particular, that's the source of some of the really concrete numbers we have on these impacts. They estimate these very large returns to investment. And I just want to say very quickly, part of this is that this involves projections over the lifetime of a child. So that increased earnings over their entire lifetime adds up to a lot of money. So that's part of why these numbers are so gigantic. And also this is imagining this being implemented at a national level, just to be clear. Other estimates of return to investment on this policy that are done at the program level also suggest very substantial returns to investment on these policies. In terms of why this is a good fit here, like most places in the United States, Pima County also has a strong geographic concentration of poverty. The extremes represented here from as low as 3% in suburban areas to 56% in one census tract downtown. There's a heavy overlay of the spatial distribution of poverty with the patterns of racial segregation in Tucson. There's no need to go into the long history here. These things are obviously related. So you have high concentration of racial minorities, also overlapping with areas of concentrated disadvantage. Not perfectly, but a very, very strong spatial relationship between those two. And then on top of all of that, no surprise to anyone, measures of opportunities geographically also correspond to those patterns of poverty geographically, as do neighborhood vulnerability metrics. All sort of overlay on one another spatially in Pima County and Tucson. All of which to say is efforts to break down this geographic concentration of poverty are trying to break apart some of these sort of very stable overlaying layers of inequality that shape opportunity in our community. What we are suggesting here has a very, very strong overlap and alignment with multiple local and federal priorities. So the city of Tucson's HASP, the Housing Affordability Strategy, explicitly recommends something very similar to the policies we put forward here. The Regional Affordable Housing Commission also has elements that are very similar to these policy prongs. And we think that these suggestions, these policy proposals are also extremely consistent with HUD's affirmatively for furthering fair housing mandate, which is sort of getting renewed attention and a renewed push in recent years. Here are just some quotes from the policy brief that was provided to you in terms of the research. So one, the first quote on the top left there is just pointing out that it's been sort of abundantly documented that if you are a low-income person, there are constraints that you experience as a result of your low income. But being a low-income person in a low-income neighborhood also brings additional challenges and vulnerabilities to communities and to individuals. And so this is just sort of speaking to the fact that, you can think of just addressing poverty through the safety net, for example, but not addressing the geographic concentration of vulnerability and the concentration of opportunities that exist above and beyond the individual households. Situation is really important to take into account. The second quote here is just, this is a kind of a recent summary review of research on housing mobility programs. And again, this is a place where I'm trying to think of how to say this. As I said earlier, data that allows you to make a strong evidence-based claim about breaking intergenerational poverty is just super hard to do because you need incredibly long-term longitudinal data on families over time. It's just very, very hard to do. But housing mobility programs are one of the areas where there's been a really impressive amount of evidence supporting that capacity to break those multi-generational cycles. The middle quote here on the other side of the screen, children who relocated to low poverty areas had incomes $1,624 higher on average. So that's, you know, in 1 year earlier in their career. And then when you project those differences, those kind of different trajectories forward over time, it adds up to really large differences. And again, those estimates are sort of based on, are based on some of the kind of highest quality research that we have on this, right? Extremely rigorous experimental designs over decades, looking at income outcomes over time. And so again, that's this uniquely strong evidence that we have for this policy. And then the last piece there is just about intergenerational poverty, that this is effective at that, which I mentioned. Then some implementation ideas. Bonnie, I don't know if you want me to go through these or we just want to leave them on the screen. I'm not sure.
Yeah, just in the way that we've designed the policy brief, we want to make sure there's a section at the end where we can capture implementation ideas, right? Because there's, you know, low cost, high cost, lots of stuff in between, but really giving some examples of how this policy could be implemented.
And I just want to stress that these are examples, and some of these are from the researchers, some of these are from community members, and some of these are from people working in local government. So this is sort of a very flexible part of this. So, you know, us being here now is sort of providing these examples to you, and we're looking for feedback. So the first one here is identification and regular review of high opportunity areas, which would be necessary to implement any type of housing mobility programs. Transportation planning and investments in high opportunity areas with affordable housing to address inadequate traffic capacity. So this is trying to kind of preemptively address some of the concerns about those investments. Zoning code changes to facilitate more housing in high opportunity areas. Bonus points on applications for funding of affordable housing development. Prioritize and seek proposals to develop affordable housing on surplus government property. Prioritize housing vouchers to be used in high opportunity neighborhoods coupled with counseling and navigation services. So number six, I just want to stress this is what most of the research is focusing on, is at these types of mobility programs. And the research is very clear that these programs are dramatically more effective when they're coupled with navigation services. So if you help folks connect with landlords, identify realistic opportunities for them to relocate, that tends to make a dramatic difference in terms of the efficacy and impact of these programs. Identify new funding sources to support affordable housing production. And then multiple folks have suggested that homeowner assistance and similar supports can also support housing mobility. So if you help someone purchase a home in a lower poverty neighborhood than where they're coming from, that can really be a nice platform for their new life in that neighborhood.
And I just want to mention that we have taken these ideas out to 29 adults. Most of them were parents, and just sharing a little bit of their feedback. We had good conversations and then like a survey tool with Likert scales. And this was some of the feedback that we got and just some of the comments that we got as well. So with that, we'd love to open it up for questions. And I know that was a lot of information in a condensed amount of time, but we want to make good use of the time, so, and leave as much of this for questions and conversation.
Thank you, Bonnie and Keith. That was a great presentation. Who has questions or comments? Joanna?
Yeah, thank you for this. This is really exciting to see an effort to look at things long-term. I just had a question just on the last slide. Have you considered, it mentioned affordable development within areas of opportunity, but has there been consideration around mixed income projects specifically? So just thinking about, like, you know, like the mandatory inclusion rezoning model, which I know we can't do here because of state law, but that model
has shown, like in research, you know, real success in building prosperity, as opposed to having like one affordable housing development within a community that then kind of creates segregation within that unit itself. Not unit, sorry, property.
That's a really exciting idea, Joanna. Keith, have you, would love to get the sources of that as well. And Keith, have you run across any of that?
Yeah, no, I have seen research along those lines. I will say that we did kind of remove that term, mixed income housing, from this previous version of this draft. And I might defer to Allison a little bit on the feedback we got to that. But essentially, the concern was that we, like you said, we can't do that here. So folks wanted to kind of not put an unrealistic mandate in the policy. But I completely agree that those create good opportunities. The research is there for that. And I do think that that would, it sounded to me, Allison, correct me if I'm wrong, if we did push for that, it would just have to be a voluntary ask of developers, it was my impression. So I'll stop there because that's the limit of my knowledge on that.
Thank you.
I'll just say, I think in the context of sort of mixed income as a piece of either kind of the mobility housing policy, or in kind of, you know, investing in higher poverty areas, I think makes sense. I think, also looking, we'll look to Anne and Corin. I think, you know, when we were sort of talking about mixed income and including that in the policy language itself, the concerns were really around, you know, defining terms and, kind of, you know, making sure we're clear about whether we were, if the true, you know, policy was that we wanted to create mixed income development, and if that was the case, like if that's the policy goal, then, as you said, there's some kind of challenges there. Whereas if the larger policy goal is kind of creating these mixed income neighborhoods and providing kind of more housing mobility and housing choice, that's kind of where we ended up going in terms of the wording, if that makes sense. But again, this is all sort of, this is for this commission to discuss, and really appreciate your feedback and thoughts on really what makes the most sense for Tucson and Pima County and how we want to word things.
Thanks, Allison.
Mark?
Dr. Patel, I'm curious about the mobility issues and if there's been any research on the impact of that on familial and mutual support and breaking up what have been sort of traditional communities of interest. I know we have an interesting, you know, we have very, what's perceived as a very successful public housing renovation project, Hope 6 program, which is now Posada Sentinel, used to be County Chambers. Certainly when they did that, there were some concerns about that process as a lot of those residents got scattered around or, you know, dispersed out into probably higher, what were perceived as higher opportunity areas. So I'm wondering, is there any research in the literature out there that addresses, that looked at those issues that might be informative?
Certainly. The only research I've seen addressing those issues is very qualitative. And so those interviews of folks who have relocated, what I've seen sort of stresses both sides of it, right? Just in the sense that people kind of have feelings about losing neighbors or being farther away from family members. But very frequently there's sort of enormous other positive benefits that have come to relocating. And so my read on that is that it's a very mixed bag. And when you look at the kind of overall metrics that you can see in the quantitative literature that, you know, that are kind of asked of everyone in terms of like mental health, satisfaction with their neighborhood, again, their overall improvement in their life are pretty dramatic in terms of the positive impacts. So I think there is a trade-off there, but the evidence I've seen seems to suggest that people are generally very happy. The other thing I'll say is that for the most part, these are small programs. So they're not, you know, you're not having like drain from a whole neighborhood, right? And so that's not how they work. And that's not the scale that they've been operating at in general. So I think those, I'm not concerned about that. I don't know that we're going to be having that problem, honestly. And then there's also self-selection, right? Where people who are interested in this and do want to relocate, they don't have to, right? The voucher is an opportunity for them to relocate. And then they also have a lot of choice over where they choose to relocate as well. So I'm honestly less concerned about that. I do understand the concern. But again, because it is voluntary and because it's going to affect, not as many people as maybe I would hope in practice, I'm less worried about that. But it is definitely a valid concern.
Shay, I'm going to recognize you first and then me.
Okay, thanks. I was going to say you could go first, Jim. Thank you. I was kind of similar lines. I mean, I've read other articles where the same issue came up and they, it's a hard reality of like, well, you have to basically leave your family and community to do better sometimes because those environments are so toxic. And so, I get it. But at the same time, like, I think that equally what's underplayed is that there's also really healthy kinship networks and like really healthy networks that exist within poverties and community as well. So on the flip side, you have both, right? You have those strong church families and the strong activists, like there's all sorts of mix of people who have like those core ideals that help create and foster community, even when you don't have a lot of money. So, but I think that for me, the other issue, the flip side of all of this, because this issue all sort of came up, which I agree on a high level with everything you've presented, Keith. This is excellent data and research. And in general, yes, I would love to see policy and whatever we're doing here shift this way. But I think also in response to kind of some of the issues about how you address like gentrification, right? And how you like also acknowledge that lower income areas also still need high quality affordable housing and also still need, to be protected if and when these kinds of major shifts take place. I think that the answer is also still affordable housing and still providing those LIHTC programs and those, really high. I think you have to also on the flip side, like make sure that, especially in areas that are like gentrifying, like the solution is to put in the affordable housing early on, especially units that are, get the land trust in there as soon as you can, because those properties are still affordable, and get the LIHTC projects in as soon as you can, because especially when you have like for example in Tucson, we know that the choice neighborhoods and all the impact and economic investment that's going to bring, right? Like when you have these like really large planned areas where you know investment's going to go in, and I think that there's ways that you can also plan ahead strategically for that and try to protect as many housing units as you can before the wave of development gets to those areas. So I think that there's another sideline policy to addressing also how you protect existing lower income neighborhoods.
Thank you so much for that. I just want to start by saying 100% agree with everything you just said. And that's part of why, I was saying to Bonnie and Nicole that starting with the housing mobility piece to me always felt iffy, because number one, what you just said, the first response everyone has is, but what about affordable housing? That's obviously the main concern. So I think we're stipulating, and these are the discussions we've had, that everyone agrees there's a need for more affordable housing, but that's not our specific role here because of our focus on the intergenerational poverty piece. And then to your second, and other folks are working on that, like you all, and there's like many layers of push in that direction. So I just want to say, I totally agree with that. And if you want to talk about reducing poverty, reducing housing costs through the development of affordable housing, it's obviously to me like the main strategy. But this piece is more thinking about if we're going to shift the spatial distribution of poverty in Tucson slowly over time, that requires really intentional development that goes against those patterns, right? And then secondarily, the second policy, which to me in the short term is the most important, is focused on what you're talking about, that there's all these patterns of investment into low-income neighborhoods right now that are not focused on developing affordable housing and that are not focused on developing mixed-income housing, that are going to raise rents, they're going to raise house prices, and people are going to get displaced. And these are the most vulnerable folks. And so for me, that piece of developing hopefully what looks like some kind of very substantive eviction prevention and rental assistance program that is citywide, that is what my dream and hope would be for that second policy in terms of implementation, and those protections would be focused specifically on those neighborhoods that are vulnerable to gentrification. And I'll just say at the end, like, there's a little paragraph in the HAST that says specifically that these neighborhoods need to be prioritized for those types of protections, but then there's like nothing there after that. So just in terms of implementation or specific policies. And so I'm really hoping that that second policy prong speaks to what you're addressing. And again, I just want to add that, you know, it is true. I 100% agree, low-income neighborhoods, you have people working together. They've been there for generations. They're strong communities, but you also have folks who are low income, who are just getting cycling in and out of different units over and over and over, and they're going from bad unit to bad unit to bad unit. Those folks don't have stable communities. They don't have like a high quality of life in terms of their housing stability. And so for those types of families, I think if you have an opportunity to get a housing voucher and be in a much nicer neighborhood and all the other things that that brings, I think that's a real opportunity. But I would never recommend that as the only strategy, right? Because that's, to me, piecemeal. Like I said before, it's only going to serve a certain number of households, and it doesn't address the root causes of poverty in those really high concentration areas that are just, you know, affecting people negatively day to day in a grinding way. So I'll stop because I'm going on for too long, but thank you for your question.
Thank you. And then I had one quick other question for the city. Did I remember there being like a, with the map and that, I think it was the map research that was done, a map that showed where those higher income, those areas of opportunity were? Is that still, and there's like a scoring metric. Is that still something that's being considered to be put in place?
I'm happy to talk, or Allison, if you want me to jump in here. So yes, Shay, and I think we've brought this to you all before, that HCD has been working on an opportunity mapping for this very reason. I would call it still very much draft, in that we want to make sure, we want to be careful with it, and feedback from you all has been really helpful in making sure that we really think through potential consequences of using the map for things like prioritizing housing in certain locations. So we definitely are continuing to work on it. We'll be hiring a new data GIS person soon, and this will be on their list of projects to bring up, to pick back up with input from you all on what, making sure we have the map attributes right, and then really thinking through what the implementation looks like and trying to think through how best to use the map. So yes, we have a draft and it needs some work.
Yeah, because to me that seems like the most useful kind of tool that could, you know, help directly address what Keith and Bonnie have presented today, which, yeah.
And I'll say for folks, I would say the Housing Desegregation Subcommittee is sort of where that map has been discussed the most. And so one of the things I think they've continued to offer input, and feel free to anyone else to jump in there. But yes, we're working on it.
And Shay, if I can just say thank you so much for those comments. And it's very much aligns with a lot of the other conversations we've had, even just in the last week. And so I put into the chat, and I should have changed it out on the slide, my apologies. But so we've, you know, and thanks to the conversations with the city, we have sort of broken out some additional areas, which might not be, this might be more considered infrastructure than housing, but it, you know, invest in disinvested neighborhoods so that they become springboards for their residents, develop effective strategies to preserve affordable housing and prevent displacement. And some of that language was taken right from, I think it was Urban Institute or one of those national policy centers. So all of this really aligns with what the national conversation is as well. And then, you know, we have the home ownership policy, and then we want to develop an eviction prevention policy as well. So, so all of that really aligns. And also just an FYI, and I'll send it off to you, Anne, once you've got it done. We're working on just looking at what are the indicators that some of the national opportunity maps are using, like Diversity Data Kids has 29 indicators, City Health has 36 or something like that. So we're just sort of taking a review of that, and I'll send that off to you, Anne. We're putting in a spreadsheet just to kind of think about, you know, what are the indicators that you'd want to plug into an opportunity map. And I think Jay created one of the early ones. I'm not sure what all he plugged into his, but I think that's a key piece of this as well.
Bonnie, I believe Ryan Stevenson, is that his last name?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He mentioned he's also, he'd updated a previous version of the map using the prior elements. So just, I feel like he's on the team with us, and he's also been working on that as well. So.
So we'll combine efforts so we end up with one good map.
Okay, Shay, anything else? Okay, so first of all, I like how you guys are going about this, looking at it from a poverty perspective. I believe that I call this the three S's of housing, which is safe, sustainable, and stable. If you have safe, stable, and sustainable housing, that is the key for breaking the poverty cycle in our younger generation. So I think you guys are looking at this the right way. From a housing perspective, an affordable housing perspective, 90 to 95% of the affordable housing units built are built through the low-income housing tax credit program. So I think, you know, I kind of keyed in on your implementation ideas slide in terms of how you meet these goals. And there's a couple of things that jumped out to me on that slide. So I think some of the recommendations that you have are in line with what we've been coming up with as a commission. So the zoning changes is consistent with the recommendations that we provided to Mayor and Council. There's a note on here about affordable housing bonds, which I think is great. Finding and seeking new sources. So we've talked about reestablishing the housing trust fund for the city. I think it's important that given that most of the housing is done through the low-income housing tax credit program, when you talk about prioritizing certain areas or bonus points on applications for funding of affordable housing developments, that you do that through the lens of the affordable housing, the LIHTC program, and looking at that QAP. And I would encourage you, one of the things that I'd like to see us do as a community is do a better job of coming together and providing feedback to the state on how we think that the state should be prioritizing the affordable housing programs. Because I think one of the things that sometimes happens is we have the city or the county or these different groups saying, we want to do something here. And the state saying, no, you've got to do something else over here. And the net result is because nobody sees eye to eye, nothing ends up happening. And so it's important, I think, for you guys to pay attention to when the feedback session happens for the QAP, the Qualified Allocation Plan, from the state, the Arizona Department of Housing, and provide feedback to them just as for as much as possible to keep priorities, try to keep priorities aligned. That makes sense. So I did have one question on item number four, which is bonus points on applications for funding. Is that city funding from the county or funding from the city? Or who's that funding from?
Mr. Chair, Nicole Feitz with the Pima County Administrator's Office. So, and we just, it could, so whichever city or town or county ends up adopting a policy, you know, you can come up with your own implementation measures. This particular one, when we issued a RFP for gap funding proposals recently, we provided a section that enabled respondents to provide just sort of a qualitative response to why an area was a higher opportunity area or not, and provided additional points for that.
Okay, thank you. Allison?
Yep, sorry. Someone woke up from her nap. I just wanted to note that Joe had a question in the Q&A about home ownership, and that Jay couldn't make it, but he sent some comments. So I know Lori was going to read them, but she had to drop off. But I think Bonnie and the team have those, but happy to also pull those up and try to give the gist of it.
Sorry, I have an emergency. Is it going to hurt the quorum if I drop up, if I leave the meeting?
No, it should not.
Okay, thank
we'll,
you.
We'll be down. We'll be down to eight when you leave.
Okay, thank you. Naked woman in the park who's refusing care. So, gotta go. Thank you.
Good luck.
Yeah, all the best. I do have the Jay's comments here. Allison, did you want me to read them?
I mean, maybe just the gist. I think he wanted to share, have his thoughts shared with the commission, but we can also forward them to everybody.
Sure. Let me just give you the highlights here. He said, he says he's excited about this work because it aligns with what we've been wrestling with in the Housing Desegregation Subcommittee and where we believe our work as the full commission needs to go. It's in alignment with our subcommittee's recommendation to the full commission that Lori will share during our subcommittee report. The framework is critical for conceptualizing equity and taking measurable action to improve prosperity for everyone. He feels like it's the missing piece. It allows us to look at that equity piece and gives us a framework for that, a missing piece of the puzzle. And he's also, because of the affirmatively forwarding fair housing rule that was there in 2015 and now the Biden administration has reissued, he feels like this puts Tucson and Pima County ahead of the curve with HUD and helps the Housing and Community Development Department meet its goals. So that's kind of his highlights.
I'm happy to just take a quick stab at Joe's question. So the homeownership policy form and recommendation is still in development. But yes, I would say for me, there should be a multi-pronged approach supporting lots of different types of options for people in different financial situations. So I think that those would be on the table. But again, for me, you know, there's this weird line between like what the policy is and what the research says and then what the actual implementation is, which we are trying to leave to the local jurisdictions. So those to me feel like implementation details, but the spirit of providing a wide range of options that are, you know, are kind of scaffold for people to kind of buy in at different levels, I think is the way to go.
Okay, thank you. Any other thoughts or questions before we move to the next agenda item? All right. Well, Bonnie, Keith, Nicole, thank you very much. I enjoyed your presentation and good job.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate the time.
Thank you all. I really similarly appreciate your time.
Okay. So agenda item number 6 is a visual presentation on the HCD's BCHIP funding process. And Ann and Jason are going to lead this discussion, which I don't, is Jason with us?
No, so I offered to step in here. Jason's at the Coalition to End Homelessness Conference. So he is currently in Oakland and he was gonna try to tune in the midst of the conference and I offered to do this. So I'm going to start out trying to provide a little more context. I know that last month Jason presented on the rental developments because that particular funding cycle is on a more aggressive timeline to align with the QAP and try to make sure that we're letting folks who are applying for low-income housing tax credits know. But we do have other funding processes. And one thing I'll say is we are not asking for any action today. We're prepping you as next month we'll be presenting a little more information specific to the different funding sources. So today is background information. Also want to say that we're trying to figure out, this is the first year that the commission has existed, that we are doing these funding rounds. And so we're really open to your ideas on how to include the commission. Of course, many of you here are on the commission because of your expertise in this area, which also can be problematic in terms of conflicts of interest. And so trying to figure out how to include you all, get good feedback, and avoid any sort of conflicts of interest. So background today, we will be bringing more information to you next month to review, and similar to last month, make sure that nobody is wildly opposed to the funding recommendations before they go to mayor and council. I do have a short presentation, and we'll get that going. Can you see the presentation?
Yep. Yes.
Okay. So background information, like last month, I think the item was listed as PCHIP, rental housing, something, something. And one of the things we talked about with Vicky is trying to be a little clearer on what agenda items, sort of what we're saying and doing. And I think staff, we talk about PCHIP a lot. And many of you probably are familiar with what PCHIP is, and others might be less familiar and or might need a reminder. So I wanted to help provide that context today that in 2021, Mayor and Council adopted the People, Communities, and Homes Investment Plan, which is really the guiding document for our department in terms of the funding we give away. And so the idea of people, communities, and homes is really we envision every Tucsonan having access to safe, decent, and affordable home. We know that's people's anchors. We know, everyone here knows how important the home is. However, there's also providing services and support for individuals is also really important to and then having neighborhoods and public spaces and nonprofits that really support the overall people's overall well-being and quality of life. So that's where People, Communities, and Homes Investment Plan comes in, or PCHIP for short. And so I mentioned Mayor and Council adopted this plan in 2021. It's available on our website. And there's four sections to the plan. I'm not gonna go into the plan today, but just know it's always there if people have questions about it. The four sections, we really tried to not reinvent the wheel and summarized a lot of the related work. So that's the inputs section. We have a section on current conditions and challenges. There's a lot of data that was developed in 2020. So like everything, I think data probably needs to be updated. There's a section that lays out the PCHIP priorities and goals. And then there's a section focused on implementation. And just we developed this plan sort of right during the first year of the pandemic. And so in-person meetings were not allowed to happen. However, in 2020, fortunately, a lot of other related efforts we were able to use data and outreach and information from other efforts, such as the city's consolidated plan process had just wrapped up. So overall, we were even despite the pandemic, we were still able to get a lot of input. There was a survey and also a budgeting tool that was released, and that really helped inform the priorities and goals. And so for the survey, the five categories of funding priority, you can see here affordable housing coming out on top, and services for people experiencing homelessness, education, training, transportation, mobility, and health really came out on top for the survey. And so in the PCHIP plan, the whole point of the planning process was to help guide where HCD invests, what we invest in terms of projects and programs and in services. And so based on all of the outreach that was done, it really lays out what the funding priorities should be. And so you'll see the underlined words are areas that the community expressed real interest in supporting. And then on the right, you'll see the target populations being children and youth, people experiencing homelessness, and older adults. One thing I'll say to you, we're bringing a lot of different funding sources to you. And I know that sometimes can be confusing if you're not used to our department's funding and what each funding source is. In the plan, we do lay out a summary of all the funding sources HCD receives on an annual basis and try to give just a brief primer on what those funding sources can do, what they can't do. And so all of that is in the plan. And then when we know we have funding available, we post on the website, we in our newsletter, in social media, we try to get the word out that, hey, we have affordable homeownership money available. And so it's the PCHIP affordable homeownership process. And so whenever funding cycles come, we post on the website and we try to do a lot of information to disseminate that information. And so that leaves me to this year's funding cycle round. And this is where, if Jason was here, he'd jump in since Jason oversees all of this. But here is just an overview. So HCD, as you all know, we receive money from HUD. And then some of the money too, there's some general fund money from mayor and council that also goes to what we call human services. And so much of the funding, the cycle varies depending on the funding source, but most of it we do every 2 years. So we know it's a lot of time and effort from nonprofits to put together proposals, really want to try to see those programs succeed. So we're on a 2-year cycle for most of the funding. However, things like affordable home ownership for LIHTC gap funding, we do on an annual basis. And so this year is one of the, every other year, this is a year where we are doing lots of cycles to make sure we're getting the money out that we receive. And so in October or November, depending on which of the programs or funding available, we issued a request for proposals or a call for projects. And then most of them were due January or February, depending on the funding cycle, depending on the funding category. In February or in March, staff has and is reviewing all the proposals to make sure they meet the requirements. And then now we're moving into where we are now and where we're going. So in March, for the panels that haven't yet met, we'll be putting together and have put together scoring panels that will start reviewing and rating and recommending projects. And so another component this year, thanks to Lori Swalker with the Office of Equity, she did help us in terms of thinking through equity considerations in the proposals and having that be a piece of the scoring. And so In April, we do plan on presenting again and giving you information about scoring and which projects and programs are recommended for funding based on the scoring committee's review. And the reason why it's important to do that in April is we need to have mayor and council finalize the funding recommendations to then build them into our annual action plan, which needs to be approved in May. And that's what's that's where HUD won't give us money unless we have an annual action plan. So the timeline is pretty important here. And one of the things in terms of the bulk of the funding for human services, we did invite anyone on the commission who wouldn't have a conflict of interest or perceived conflict of interest. So I do know some of you will be on the scoring panels, and we really appreciate that. And so on the community development side, so we have community development funding and human service funding. We released a call for projects for public facilities. So projects that are in the public right-of-way, like sidewalk projects or in public spaces such as parks projects, or the public facilities money can also support nonprofits facilities. So things like shelters or things like air conditioning for a shelter is an example of something that is eligible. The second area there is what we took to you all last month, and then mayor and council approved at the end of February. And then last one for community development, we did release home money specifically for affordable homeownership projects. The human services funding, there's four categories available. The first one is emergency solutions grant funding, and that's really for services related to persons experiencing homelessness. There is CDBG money for public services, human services. There is HOPLA money. And then there is also the general fund money that mayor and council gives to be able to support our nonprofits. One thing I will say, the last time we did this 2 years ago, we had some CARES money. So we had additional money we were able to provide to nonprofits. And so one consideration this year is without that money, we have half as much money as we had last time to distribute. So we do expect that, sadly, we won't be able to support all the projects and all the applications that we received. And so I know that there's a lot here in terms of what you'll be given next month to review and provide feedback if you don't have a conflict of interest for any of the funding sources. And wanted, though, to help prep you so we don't spring it on you at the next meeting and hear if you have thoughts on how we can make this process smoother going forward and or what we need to present. So these are there's six different categories that we still will need to provide funding recommendations to mayor and council. Those are all listed on the left-hand side, and our plan is to make sure that when you receive, you'll receive information about what the project or program is, a description of what it is, the amount that was requested, the amount that the committees have recommended for funding, what the application score was, and what the equity impact analysis score was. So that's the plan for next month, and just wanted to prep you for that. And so happy to take questions or thoughts or overall feedback that I can help share with Jason and team for next month or for the next time we do this process.
Thank you, Anne. Any comments or questions?
I have a comment.
Go ahead, Marianne.
Sorry I was late, you guys. I was on my phone in the car, and it was really giving me a hassle. I think the city of Tucson has a well-oiled machine in terms of how it puts out RFPs and how it works with committees and scores things. So and being a recipient of those funds from time to time, as well as an observer, I just want to say thank you to the city. And also this presentation, Anne, was very educational, I think, for anyone who doesn't know about the funding, and this type of a presentation would be good at the public meetings for like the annual report or the, I'm sorry, I'm thinking of our audit right now, of any of the meetings we have for public input. This would be a very good presentation.
Thank you, Marianne. I appreciate that. And thank you for reminding me that in terms of steps here, I mentioned, you know, you all will have a chance to weigh in next month. It goes to mayor and council, and ultimately it all gets packaged in our annual action plan to go to HUD. And there will be public input opportunities on that annual action plan. So Marianne, I appreciate that comment. We can do a version of this presentation at those meetings, and we'll make sure to share information on when those meetings are happening with you all.
Any other thoughts or questions? All right, well, Anne, we look forward to seeing what you guys are coming up with next month, and I appreciate the update.
Thank you.
Okay, so the next agenda item, we're on agenda item number 7, which is a report on the CEHD recommendations to Mayor and Council. This is mine. So this is an agenda item where we are all getting to give ourselves a pat on the back. It was a week ago, I guess. I presented to the study session for Mayor and Council on the 5 recommendations that have come out of CEHD. Mayor and Council unanimously voted to accept all 5 recommendations. So it made me feel great. Just as a quick recap, the 5 recommendations were to look for ways of reinstating the Housing Trust Fund as a supplementary source of financing on affordable housing projects. And the way we explain that is that if the city makes an investment of 2 to 3% of the total project costs, it'll help the LIHTC projects get maximum points. So we could potentially get more projects down here in Tucson. Second item was to direct development services to review and change zoning regulations in order to encourage affordable housing projects, with attention to be paid on project density, setback, building height, and a more streamlined process for zoning changes. The third item was in line with HAST Plan 9.2, which was to direct staff to evaluate the potential of adding an affordable housing bond initiative to go to the voters. The fourth item was a codified fast track approval process for affordable housing projects through development services. And the fifth item was to explore options for reimbursing the cost for the additional EV infrastructure. So Jay and I met with Ward 1, the mayor's office, Ward 3, and Ward 6 prior to the meeting. Got a couple of points of feedback. Steve Kozacek said one of the things he was hoping that we could focus on as a commission would be to look at how the city could encourage housing at some of the like power centers and malls, which are currently going through dilapidation. And the example that he gave was at Elkhorn Mall. On the northwest side of that mall, there is a giant parking lot that, for all intents and purposes, goes unused. And so his thought was, why can't there be housing added in that location, specifically affordable housing? So that's something I think that we should consider as an agenda item moving forward. As Ben Buehler-Garcia mentioned, there was discussion about just streamlining the approval process through development services, not only for affordable housing projects, but also for market rate projects. Not as much discussion as I was thinking about the bond initiative. That was kind of the big one. I think that one's going to have the biggest impact on us. So I'd be curious to see how that gets moved forward, and I'm hoping that we can stay involved. But I think it's a good thing, I feel like we're making a difference. So. Yeah, Marianne.
I want to thank you and Jay, Jim, for taking all the time you did with the mayor's office and also with the ward offices, you know, to get this done. But this is great. This is really, really great. And it'll be interesting to see how all of this dovetails with, you know, the regional, the county, you know, commission, and with the, you know, research from CIRO. I think this is the beginning of a change in Tucson and in Pima County. So yahoo.
Yeah. So it's nice to celebrate our victories once in a while. This is very difficult stuff. So any other thoughts or comments? Okay, well, let's move on to agenda item number 6, which is the Housing First Subcommittee. We need a new chair for the Housing First. So I did have, Mindy and I had lunch with Kim Brianna last month, and she said that she would be interested in joining the Housing First Subcommittee. So I think that was great. But right now we have Wendy Asher, Mindy, and then Michael Edmonds on the Housing First Subcommittee. And I believe, Michael, did you agree you're going to be chairing that going forward? Oh, you're on mute.
Thank you. I had agreed to chairing it going forward to keep it alive. However, like I think I've said previously, that I'm open to a co-chair and or a new chair. I just think that subcommittee is important. I'm sitting on two committees now, and you shared some information with me because I was trying to figure out which members of the commission are not on a subcommittee and would be willing, you know, so we could maybe reconfigure some of our subcommittees, at least so we'd have one commissioner on a subcommittee. And I'm on two right now, just to keep them alive was the idea. So I'm on Housing Desegregation and Housing First. I don't know. I'm open for a discussion on this one from everybody.
Well, do you maybe, Shay, go ahead.
Aren't we down commission? We're losing people. I mean, we're just short right now. I just feel like we're all so stretched. And how are we moving forward on not hiring, but bringing on? There were some recommendations.
There are five applications that have been submitted for individuals to join CEHD. So we've lost two, Liz, and then Joanna, because she's moved, had to drop off. And then I am not 100% sure if Olga is going to stay on board. I think she's dealing with some things personally. So we either have two or three openings for the commission, and we've got five applications. So we will be getting a couple of new members at least. And from what I understand, all the applications received are very strong. So I'm excited about that.
Can we assign them to committees where we need people?
I think so. Well, we can ask.
Yeah, it's a serious question.
Yeah, I think we can ask.
Yeah, I'm all for asking people what subcommittees they're more interested in being on. And then as for just, we kind of, I know how this is going to sound, but we just assign them to a committee if they don't choose one, and then have a discussion with them later about that. How does that sound?
Yeah, I was going to suggest the same, Mike, that we just say that their approval is contingent on them joining a subcommittee. But you know, it's part of, I think it was in our bylaws, it's an expectation that you have to participate to be on this committee.
Yep.
Maybe if it's said to them in a way that these committees need more people, this is what this committee is, this is what this committee is, and see if they'd be willing to, you know, jump in right away. You know, might be an option for the health of the subcommittees that are missing people.
Yeah, because to be honest with you, that's what happened with me. I mean, there were the subcommittees that needed someone. So, you know, Jim and I talked and I joined them.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, thank you. Well, Mike, what my suggestion is at the next subcommittee meeting, you know, when you've got everybody together, ask if somebody else wants a co-chair, and then, you know, as new commission members join, we'll definitely encourage them to go one way or another. But if they're not comfortable with it, I don't want to force people into something.
True, but we could use the name. I was thinking, that's the way I was thinking about it. Just put the name there, you know. And while I'm thinking about it, just sorry it said out loud, I apologize to Neto for not getting back to him as soon as he would hope that I would at times, so we can get this. That, I think, is why we missed, and correct me if I'm wrong, Neto, but I think that's why we missed the last Housing First subcommittees, because I didn't communicate with Neto properly and timely so we could at least schedule a meeting. That was the fault.
Correct.
Okay. So are we, Michael, are you good moving forward? And at your next subcommittee meeting, if you guys want to make a change with the chair, you can come back to the commission with that.
Yeah. And just help me, Neto, help me.
Okay.
I'm here.
Okay. So let's move to agenda item number 9, which is the subcommittee updates. We have two, but I don't know that. So Lori is not here and Jay is not here from the housing desegregation. Vicki or Mike, do either of you have an update on this last month?
I don't have an update, but let me check my notes, my subcommittee notes, and I'll let everybody else go first.
Okay. Okay. So the other one is the Affordable Housing Subcommittee, and Shay, you want to give an update on that?
Sorry, I didn't prepare. Let me get my notes.
Okay, well, we only have the two. So I'll tell you one thing that we talked about at the Affordable Housing Subcommittee was establishing a goal, an affordable housing goal. So we looked at the affordable housing pipeline and everything that's in the pipeline looking forward. And in terms of, you know, setting a goal, we also spent some time reviewing the goals, the mission and the goals of the subcommittee. And then spent a little bit of time just getting updates with HCD and what's going on there. So it was really just, I think the majority of the time was really spent talking about, you know, how do we define success in what we're doing.
I'm just going to throw this out from the Housing First Subcommittee. Let me get back to that note. We had discussion, and I'm opening this up to not only the full commission, but other people attending this meeting. We had discussion about trying to get people with lived experience more involved in conversations in our subcommittee, in the Housing First Subcommittee. So I'd like to just leave that open to everyone to say, if you know of someone who could contribute with information or experience or conversation, please point them our way through, you know, the commission, CEHD at TucsonAZ.gov, the website, or Neto, Ernesto Portillo. And that was one of the biggest things that I noticed in my notes that we were trying to, that we were planning to accomplish.
Isn't there a lived experience council in Tucson? Was that something Jason was working on? Maybe with youth specifically?
Yeah. My understanding, Joanna, is Tucson Pima Collaboration on Homelessness does have what you just described. And they do get paid to provide information and input into TPCH matters.
I wonder if that's a place you could tap, Michael.
Okay. TPCH, you say?
Yeah, and happy to, Jason can connect you there.
Okay, yeah. Do you want to do the note and do that and give it? Okay, thank you.
There was, Jay and I participated in a presentation to the NAACP this last month, and there was an individual who also presented. I think his name was James Buskey. He went through the Housing First program and he kind of talked about his experience. I can forward you his information, but I thought he was very articulate and he had a good story. That might be somebody that would be worthwhile bringing on. Vicki?
We had the Housing Desegregation Subcommittee. We had recommendations. Mike, I just forwarded those to you again. Jay had sent them, if you wanted to share them.
Okay, everyone, I'm just downloading it. Give me a moment here. Click, save. And then open. All right, let's see what we got. Maybe he read this before, maybe he didn't. But yeah, Vicki, if you want, I'll share this real quick in regards to the Housing Desegregation Subcommittee. So our recommendation from the subcommittee on behalf of Jay to the full commission. One item, refocus the CEHD's work on equity issues, including desegregation, gentrification and displacement, housing instability, and other related topics as determined by the commission. Another item, as a first step, we as the subcommittee suggest revisiting and revising our shared language, I think we have a document. I'm going to kind of riff here a little bit. I think we as a commission have a document which was put together by Liz, but I don't think we really have an official document on shared language. Some of the language, of course, is set by HUD and other agencies, which we don't have any control over, but others we kind of, I think we need to agree to or determine what we're going to say. Now, to continue with Jay's thought, revise shared language and definitions in equity and plain language that can be easily understood and used by all, whether it be the commission as well as the public. We'd also like to create a visual representation of the equity issues framework that we are using. I'm going to leave that for Jay to explain a little bit more detail. I assume he wants something, you know, graphic presentation or something that we could use to help describe some items. And the third and last, we would like to engage with Mayor and Council in ongoing dialogue about the equity issues that we are focusing on. And I believe Jay is speaking of the subcommittee engaging with Mayor and Council, if possible. We will listen to the Mayor and Council to understand our constituents' housing concerns and educate Mayor and Council about equity issues that our commission is working on. Again, I believe Jay's intention is for the subcommittee to listen and then speak with Mayor and Council, if allowed, if authorized, if possible. And that's it, Jim.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments regarding the subcommittee updates? Shay?
Yeah, I'm just curious why, I don't know, it just seems weird to me that the committee would want to go speak to Mayor and Council without also addressing the rest of our group. I guess I'm just confused as to what that process.
I think generally what Jay wants and I guess
look like. Jay. I don't know. I mean, I'm.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I think it's a lag thing. I'm sorry, Shay. I believe, again, speaking for Jay, I believe what he wants to do is to get more of an understanding related to equity and the understanding between the subcommittee and Mayor and Council in regards to issues. Are we thinking the same? Are our language as well as our thoughts and intentions, you know, together? I believe.
Yeah, I'm confused. I got the email too that Jay had sent out earlier about this other framework. It just seems like there's a lot and I don't know what's going on in the subcommittee. And I would love to just get a general update of like what that's just. So I'm just feeling lost and confused. I think we'll just have to wait till Jay is here next time.
Yeah, it might be best if I let Jay then answer directly those concerns.
Marianne?
I do have a problem with the subcommittee going to mayor and council on its own. I think that starts a trend that we don't want. I don't see any problem with subcommittee members going with, you know, Jim, you know, or something agreed upon with the larger committee. But I just see that being a real problem with communication, conflict, dialogue. It's just messy, and I am absolutely opposed to it.
Okay. I did, Marianne, I don't think his intention is to do it without permission from the commission. I think that he just wanted to state his thoughts.
Yeah, I think what he wanted to do, if based on my discussions with him, is, you know, the five recommendations that went to Mayor and Council came through the Affordable Housing Subcommittee. I think he's looking to create the next set of recommendations from the Housing Desegregation Subcommittee, but it would have to go through the commission as a whole and get buy-in and an understanding from the commission as a whole before it gets sent to.
Yeah, that's great. That explains, it's much clearer now. So thank you for that. And I still think that, you know, Jim and somebody from the CEHD committee versus somebody from a subcommittee going forward with this as well, just like you just did.
Yeah. Vicki?
Yeah, I just wanted to try to help clarify. And I'm on that subcommittee, but I had to leave a few minutes early. Mike, I don't remember talking about actually going to mayor and council. So I almost wonder if just the notes weren't clear. The discussion that I was involved in was about doing visits to ward offices like you just did, Jim, with another member on the equity issues. And because I remember asking a question about what the purpose of the meetings was it to be, you know, like educational or to gather information about, you know, the issues related to, you know, desegregation that they were hearing about in the wards. And so that's what I recall about the conversation, is sort of more informal meetings with the different ward offices, to just do some education on equity issues, but also to get some feedback on issues. And then the other thing I can say about the shared language, just to clarify, the document that we have on shared language is actually a PowerPoint. And it was actually before I joined the commission. So I think you probably had a whole presentation on it. And it's a PowerPoint document. And so I can speak to this because I brought it up. I find it a bit cumbersome to go through. And so just in referencing it. And so that was just a suggestion to revisit it and see if we could put some of that in plain language. And just the subcommittee, we looked at one or two of the initial definitions and just talked about, well, you know, is that actually our shared definition now after, you know, like a year of operation? Maybe we want to tailor that language a bit and maybe still have that PowerPoint and the full presentation, but then a simpler document of almost, you know, like a glossary of definitions. And then the visual piece, we struggled with naming it, but sort of all of that shared language and all these concepts we talk about, could we create something visual? We have a lot of other visual representations of things. Just, you know, all of those sort of equity issues that we need to keep in mind as we're with discussions and things come up, could we come up with some type of visual representation so you can see it at a glance? Mm-hmm. I don't know if that helped at all, but that's what I remember.
Yeah. And Marianne, I'll agree with Vicky. That is the conversation I remember us having in the subcommittee. Now, because I know what I said, and I was reading off of the notes. Yeah, I remember our conversation. Our thought was, yeah, we're not going to go to mayor council. We'll go to the ward offices to have conversations.
Thank you, Vicky. Marianne?
Yes. Again, I think that we just need to follow protocol in the with the umbrella of the committee approving these kinds of things and understanding, you know, what these conversations are going to be like, because in a sense, you're representing the full committee, and that's my concern, is that if these conversations that you're going to have don't happen with the committee first, so that committee members can put in, have feedback and talk about it. I mean, no one on the Housing Commission, you know, went out ahead of the commission, and then when we put these proposals forth, that's when Jim and Jay went around and talked to people, because we were all on the same page. My concern is that we are not going to be on the same page, and that it's going to cause a PR problem for this commission. And that is what I just want us to be able to avoid, which is why I'm saying this.
So Marianne, Neto, we need to get the approved bylaws on our website. But I believe if we look at those, it's been a while since I've looked at them, but I believe that any recommendations that go to mayor and council need to go through the full commission before presented. I'm pretty sure that's in our bylaws.
Okay, we'll do.
But we can double check that, Marianne. And I think we're covered there. Vicky?
Yeah, just one more thing to Marianne's concern. I don't think the intention was to do any of that, like in the next month, you know, moving forward without talking to the full commission. I think we were just trying to capture our ideas for action items of things that, you know, sort of tangible goals that we can work toward. And again, I don't think the meetings were recommendations. It was more to gather information and talk about some equity issues. And I can't speak for the rest of it because I wasn't there, but my impression was we weren't asking, you know, for approval to just move forward with it, but to give an idea of like, okay, these are the action items we came up with. How does that sound? And then as we fine tune it, we would come back to the full commission. Is that how you took it, Mike?
Yeah, because again, I'm looking at the wording here. It's a recommendation from our subcommittee, from the desegregation subcommittee to the full commission. We would like to engage with mayor and council. So it's not like we're going to just go do it. So we're saying we would like to.
I just wanted to. Did no one else add anything? Sorry.
Go ahead, Jay.
I just wanted to. I thought that the piece that what I understood from the email that went out was that we wanted that. I thought that what Jay wanted us to do as a commission was to work on an equity framework, which I think is the first step before you talk to mayor and council, and before you. I think we all need to get on the same page and have an understanding of what that is. And I thought that he really wanted to dig into that, which I again, without him being here, it's hard. But I do, I really liked that idea. And I think that I would imagine that we would go through some sort of process like that before jumping into making any kind of any recommendation. I think and that to me goes hand in hand with the suggestion of having that shared document of language. I think this is the whole concept of equity is very broad, and I've wrestled with it, you know, because we're overlaying it on top of housing specifically, right? So I think that those kinds of philosophical and ethical questions and conversations, I felt like that was my understanding of where Jay wanted to head.
Okay, if you guys are okay, let's continue. We're at 5:55, so we're getting close to the end of the meeting, and we can continue this conversation next month when Jay's back. So item number 10 is HCD updates. Anne?
I'll just keep this brief and mention one given the time, but one thing to be aware of on the mayor and council agenda, the last meeting, they did approve a pre-exclusive negotiating agreement. And what that is an agreement between FSL and HCD for the 2 Ward 1 lots. So just want to make sure everyone knows we are trying to move those projects forward. It's the Westmoreland lot in Dunbar Spring, and the lot next to Salvation Army. Sorry, that one's Dunbar Spring. The other one is in Menlo Park. And I bring this up because we are going to start having public meetings related to those projects. So the first one is in Dunbar Spring on Saturday, March 18th at 10 a.m. And so HCD will be working with FSL, and their architect is Poster Murder McDonald, on trying to create affordable homeownership homes for that site, and then also the site in Westmoreland. But that one's scheduled Saturday, March 18th at 10 a.m. And I'll leave it there. Just, Jim, I know that you all have to figure out a date for your next meeting. So I know that's important.
Okay, thank you, Anne. Any questions for Anne? Okay, next meeting is scheduled for April 6th, which happens to be Passover. So I was hoping we could look at our calendars. Does April 5th, the Wednesday of that week, work? Is Wednesday okay for our next meeting?
So let me just clarify. The holiday begins the evening of that Wednesday. So that would be actually worse than...
That's even worse.
Yeah.
Okay. How about the 4th then? The Tuesday. That's not good?
The mayor and council meeting date?
That's mayor and council meeting. So what about the following, if we just push it one so week?
We could go with the Thursday. That's not a problem. The Thursday. If you're worried about Passover.
Oh.
Yeah, because Passover lasts for a week. It's really the first night of it and the last night of it that are bigger deals for people who are observant. And so the first night of Passover would be that Wednesday. So the meeting scheduled on the Thursday shouldn't be a problem.
Okay, then let's go ahead and keep the meeting as scheduled. I'm sorry.
It's fine. Happy to be your source of information.
Okay, so our next meeting is April 6th and then April May 4th. Are there any agenda items that the commission members would like to have on our next meeting? Okay, well, if you have them, please email Ernesto, Michael, and I, and we'll make sure to get them on the agenda. And if there is no further business, we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.